This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we read two stories from the December 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. First, In Video Veritas by Larry Tritton. Although he liked to point out to visitors that he got all of the channels, over 35 of them, Kapinski had never really thought about Channel 1 until the night when his cat Eyesore jumped up on the cable box on top of the TV set. Kapinski had been watching The Terror of Tiny Town, a Western with an all-midget cast, and Eyesore stepped on several of the buttons on the cable box, which changed the channel several times in rapid succession, creating a montage of fleeting images. A housewife serving her family heaping bowls of something that looked like bog soil. A hypnotist evangelist putting an old woman into a trance by swinging a crucifix on a chain back and forth before her eyes. A naked teenage girl dancing convulsively with her partner who couldn't see the axe sticking in her back. A comedian smashing a watermelon with a sledgehammer. A painting by Modigliani. A food fight in a sushi bar that culminated on Nameless Channel 1. "Hey, creep," Kapinski yelled and threw a .22 caliber bullet at the cat. It was one of a handful of bullets that Kapinski liked to roll around in his hand while watching TV. The bullet missed Eyesore, but the cat, annoyed, jumped back down to the floor and ran out of the room. The illuminated red number on the cable box was 1, and the screen of the television set was blank, as if it hadn't been turned on. There wasn't even the characteristic snow one found on the other inoperable channels. Kapinski reached for the remote control device and was about to change the channel back to where it had been when a picture abruptly appeared on Channel 1. He was startled by its clarity, which was like that of sharply focused film rather than television. A man who was apparently a talk show host sat behind a desk in front of a wall decorated with a painted logo of the traditional comedy and tragedy masks entwined with a banner that read, "In Video Veritas." The man was as avuncular-looking as Walter Cronkite. There were no guests in the 3 chairs across from him, and he seemed about to doze off, but suddenly snapped out of his lassitude and turned to look at Kapinski, who had the extraordinary feeling that he really was being looked at by the man personally and directly. "Do you want to know the truth?" the man asked, smiling humorlessly. "Yeah," said Kapinski, who considered himself as eager to know the truth as Diogenes had been to find an honest man. Kapinski played chains and shackles for a punk band called Crib Death, and he wrote most of their songs, which tended to be about either sex without love, or love unrequited by sex, or the hypocrisy of the modern world, which ignores or hides from the truth. "The truth is a very potent commodity," the man said, narrowing his eyes in a way that reminded Kapinski of Jack Palance in Shame. "It's been said that the truth will set you free, but it can as well put you into bondage. The truth can hurt." "Your mother's perineum," Kapinski said, and absentmindedly popped a bullet into his mouth, forgetting that they weren't candies because he was on LSD, which he had taken earlier in response to a rejection letter received from a new wave literary magazine, Logeria, to which he had sent a number of poems. The host had stopped talking and was looking at Kapinski, or seemed to be looking at him, Kapinski thought. He was staring straightforwardly from the television screen with a placid but thoughtful expression. "Weirdopolis," Kapinski muttered and tossed a bullet at the set. To his amazement, the host winced slightly. "What are those, candies you're eating?" he asked. "Those aren't candies, bozo," Kapinski said. "They're dead horseflies." "Red hots? French burst peanuts?" asked the host. He paused. "No? Is it bridge mix? You know what I used to like? Those candy Valentine hearts with phrases on them." He frowned. "We've got them here, but they have disturbing little naked facts on them. You know, your dog eats vomit. John Wayne was 4F. Miss America owns a vibrator. That sort of thing." "Jesus, this is some stuff," Kapinski said of the LSD. He had never had such a coherent and palpable hallucination as this. It was like a lucid dream. It sure as hell topped the more familiar reactions, such as seeing his hands turn into jewels as he concentrated on all the little faceted lines on his flesh, or seeing colors glow with a heightened intensity. "About the truth, then," the host said, smiling at Kapinski. "Are you sure you want to know the truth?" "Hey," Kapinski called out challengingly. "Any day, any time." He began to hum the energizing Get Her Stronger number that accompanied the training sequences in Rocky. "Well, I guess you do," the host said, pleased. "Good. Okay." He smiled faintly. "Now, the truth is that the truth is like an iceberg. Most of us sail through our lives with the truth way off the port bow somewhere, and when we do see it, we just see the tip of the iceberg and not the 3/4 of it that remains submerged. And, of course, the cold, hard facts of the truth can rip your psyche open and sink you in a slough of despair. You remember the Titanic?" "Yeah," Kapinski said, remembering the stories he had heard about men in drag who had gotten in the lifeboats with the women and children, who had been dispatched first as per tradition. "Also," the host said, "the truth is rationed somewhat. We treat it the way the government did gasoline and sugar during the war. I'll give you some today, some more the next time, if you can find me again, which is iffy. You can't just tune me in. Reception is unpredictable. The truth is elusive." Kapinski looked around the room, marveling at the resonance of the hallucination. Everything around him was terrifically clear and bright, the colors vibrant, and the image of the man on the television screen seemed virtually three-dimensional, his blue suit giving off an undertone of dusky effulgence as if the fabric were woven of subdued light, the carnation in his lapel a radiant cerise, the water glass on his desk gleaming like a polished diamond. "What kind of truth interests you?" the host asked, folding his hands on the desk. "Historical? Personal? Universal?" "Hey, I want it all," Kapinski said. "Lay it on me, Dad." "As I said," the host went on, "it's available only in increments. For starters, you'll have to choose one of those categories. I'll repeat them, and you tell me which one you want." "All right, then. Historical?" "Nah," Kapinski said. "Personal?" "Bingo," Kapinski exclaimed. He threw a bullet at the television screen. "All right," the host said. He paused and gave Kapinski a smile that gave him the impression of being apologetic. "Now, whom do you want to know the truth about? There's your girlfriend, Galatea, the band members, your mom, the bouncer," Kapinski thought. That was the nickname he had given his mother in high school, and which he had used to refer to her ever since. His relationship with his mother had always been dispassionate at best, bitterly antipathetic at worst. He figured he already knew the truth about her, that she was tyrannical and narrow-minded. He had always disliked her as much as he had loved his father. Kapinski's childhood had been considerably unhappy. Girls didn't like him, and his friends had tended to be troublesome types who were continually being sent to institutions. The only things he had really cared about were his father and his parrot, both of whom he had loved. "How about your dad?" the host asked. "I know about him," Kapinski said. "Maybe not everything," the host suggested. "Okay, all right," Kapinski said. "Enlighten me." The image on the television screen disappeared and was replaced by twisted shapes of color, like those on a pay channel whose signal is unscrambled. Then the shifting twists of color dissolved slowly into a fuzzy black and white image. It was Kapinski's room from his high school days. He leaned forward, staring in dismay. There was his dresser with the driftwood lamp with the apple green shade on it and a number of other things he remembered instantly. The brace of 50 caliber machine gun bullets standing upright, his fishing knife with the serrated blade, and his swimming goggles, some copies of Mad, the box with his arrowheads in it, a handful of felt emblems that his mother would later grudgingly sew onto a jacket for him, a winged skull and crossbones, a Marine Corps globe and anchor, a Trojan warrior, a bulldog's head, a couple of books of exploding matches, his midget deck of playing cards. Seeing these things, he remembered some of the other things in the dresser. The Vietnamese ear in a jar of preserving fluid that had been sent to him by a friend who had graduated from high school a year before him and gone to Vietnam. He had told his mother cryptically that it was a biology project, and she had never pursued the matter. The copies of Swedish porn magazines, Color Climax, Out, Out, and No, No, taped to the top of the top drawer, and the prophylactics hidden beneath his copies of Rolling Stone. Slowly, the dresser receded on the television screen, and the view of the room became more expansive. Kapinski saw the posters of Frank Zappa, Jim Morrison, and Godzilla on the wall, and in one corner, a tall bench Kapinski had made in woodshop in high school, stood Mr. Malice's cage, the top open. Mr. Malice standing motionless on his perch. "Mr. Malice," Kapinski whispered, and the vision was so affecting that for a moment he thought he had seen Mr. Malice's eye gleam momentarily with recognition at the sound of his name. Watching the bird, Kapinski felt a sudden overwhelming sensation of sadness as he remembered the day Mr. Malice had died, how he had taken the cold body from the cage, tears flooding unashamedly from his eyes, and wrapped it carefully in soft green felt that he bought at the dime store, and buried it in a shoebox near a rosebush in the backyard. Kapinski's dad walked into the room. "Jesus, Dad," Kapinski murmured. "This is weird." As Kapinski watched, his dad went over to Mr. Malice's cage. "Hey, asshole," he said to the bird. Kapinski sat up, staring at the picture. "Asshole," his father repeated. He picked up a plastic ruler and jabbed it at the bird, which scurried fearfully sideways along the perch, its zygodactyl feet clinging firmly as the perch rocked back and forth. Kapinski sighed queasily. "Devious acid," he thought, a pleasant trip suddenly mutating. "You loud-mouthed son of a bitch," Kapinski's dad said to the bird. "Can you ever shut up?" "Elroy," Kapinski heard his mother's voice say irritably from another room, "if the goddamn bird disturbs you, why don't you just talk to Malcolm about it?" "Does the son of a bitch have to scream so much?" Kapinski's dad replied, glaring at the parrot. He made a malicious feint with the ruler, and the bird tilted sideways in terror. "Why don't you just talk to Malcolm about it?" his mother's voice persisted. His dad said nothing. He put down the ruler. He made simulated claws with his hands, the fingers arching, assuming a monstrous stance, and towered over the open cage, fainting repeatedly, the frightened parrot ducking this way and that on the swaying perch. Kapinski closed his eyes for a moment, thinking that when he opened them, the ugly vision would have passed. But when he did, his dad still stood there, a bully incarnate. Kapinski remembered how Mr. Malice had periodically let out strident shrieks, but his father had never. He had actually enjoyed the sound. A moment later, Kapinski found himself watching the host again, who was smiling at him. "A little minimum of truth for you to mull over," he said. "Would you like more, or would you rather not confront it?" "I kiss the truth on the lips," Kapinski said. "The real truth." That was real. "No, it wasn't my dad. Sorry, buddy." "Well, here's a little more," said the host. The picture on the television screen wavered, disappeared, and was replaced by another one that showed Kapinski himself as a boy, walking into the living room of his house, where his dad sat reading the newspaper. Kapinski felt a strong feeling of déjà vu. He saw that he was wearing the black felt derby hat that he had bought at a carnival the year he was 11 and worn with fetishistic loyalty all that summer and fall. His expression was sulky and angry, and he was carrying a catcher's mitt with a baseball in its palm. Looking at him over his newspaper, his dad asked him what was wrong. "Oh, we were playing ball in front of the mope's house, and he came out and said if we didn't go someplace else, he'd call the cops," Kapinski said in a distraught voice of the victimized innocent. For a moment, his dad considered the complaint, and then, with a growing smile of delicious anticipation, he crumpled the pages of the newspaper together in a melodramatic gesture and stood up slowly. "Okay, he's been begging for it, and he's going to get it," he said, in a voice filled with ominous resolve. Kapinski stared at the picture wrapped. He was seeing a pictorial incarnation of one of his finest memories of his dad, the day he had straightened out the mope. The mope was the name he and Dad had given to a reclusive bachelor who lived alone in a small house in the middle of their block. Sometimes Kapinski and a friend played ball in the street in front of the house, and the mope invariably came out to ask them if they would please play somewhere else because they could easily break a window. On the particular day, the mope had finally lost his temper and shouted at them, threatening to call the police. Kapinski's dad had gone over to talk to the man, had gone inside the house, and had returned looking slightly disheveled and red-faced. When Kapinski had asked what happened, he had said mysteriously, "I got a little carried away. He won't give you any more trouble." And after a few moments added judiciously, "You know, you ought to use the diamond from now on. I don't want the guy dying of heart failure." Now Kapinski was seeing his dad leave the house and cross the street towards the mope's place, just as he had on that fall afternoon years ago. He saw his dad knock on the door, say something to the mope when he answered it, and then move aggressively inside. "Okay, what the hell is your problem, smartass?" Kapinski's dad said toughly as he stepped into the mope's living room, the screen door slamming behind him. "Look, Kapinski, I'm trying to be reasonable," the mope said in a weary voice. He backed away from Kapinski's dad, who stepped challengingly forward. "Those kids could break a window. I sit in here and watch TV. It's dangerous. All I ask is that..." "And all I ask, dumb fuck," Kapinski's dad intervened in a lethal tone, "is that you take it easy, buddy." And he emphasized the last words by jabbing his forefinger against the man's chest, once for each word, with increasing force. The mope moved swiftly and with absolute efficiency, deftly moving past Kapinski's dad to fold his arm up behind his back and slam his body against the wall. He was shorter than Kapinski's dad and perhaps 15 years older, but when Kapinski's dad struggled to free himself, the mope twisted his arm so hard and banged his head once against the wall that he cried out in pain. "Uncle," the mope said, "say uncle, Kapinski." Kapinski's dad heaved against the man's restraint, but to no avail, and within seconds his expression had become agonized, and he was whimpering in extreme pain, transfixed and helpless. "Uncle, uncle, oh Jesus," he gasped. "Ow, ow." "Say aunt, auntie," the mope instructed him in a quiet voice, and wrenched his arm fiercely. Kapinski's dad sobbed. "Aunt! Auntie! Oh! Oh! Ow! Oh, God! Let go!" "I'm going to release you now, Mr. Kapinski," the mope said. "And if you want to fight, be good, because..." And he concluded by rising on his toes so he could whisper the final words directly into Kapinski's dad's ear. "I will kill you, tough guy." Standing back, he released Kapinski's dad and stood firmly before him with one fist cocked and smiling so intensely that Kapinski's dad merely cringed against the wall, his features blurred with pain and fear. "Sayonara," said the mope. The picture on the screen vacillated again for a few seconds. Then the host returned. "The truth," he said, "uncosmeticized by predilections or desire, brass tacks, irreducible and stubborn facts, in the words of James." "James who?" asked Kapinski. The hallucinatory binge had brought him near the edge of depression, but he knew from experience that he could cope with it by reminding himself that he was on a drug and deciding to get the upper hand. "I'm on LSD," he told himself. "I'm on LSD. Hey, I'm booked for this gig, Dr. Drug. Why don't you go play somewhere else?" "Would you care for even deeper truth?" the host asked him. "Let me check the guide here first and see what else is on," Kapinski said, reaching for the newspaper's weekly television magazine on the coffee table. "There's an interesting panel discussion on veterinarians addicted to animal tranquilizers on the public access channel," the host said. "Why don't you look for me another time when you aren't on a drug?" "Good idea," Kapinski agreed. He picked up the remote control, pressed a couple of numbers arbitrarily, and exchanged the picture of the host for one of a caribou stumbling in a snowdrift. The next morning, Kapinski remembered his session with Channel 1 the same way one remembers an unpleasant dream, with a mixture of distaste and surprise that one is capable of such perverse imaginings. The LSD had left him wrung out, and he decided to skip a rehearsal the band had scheduled that afternoon and idle around the apartment, drinking coffee, reading magazines, and maybe working on a song or two that had been gestating in his brain. To his displeasure, he found that unsettling images of the night before kept distracting him. He went to the television set and switched it on, tuning in the cable box to Channel 1, Dead Air. On an impulse, he called an acquaintance of his, Ziggy Immelman, who was a couch potato. The couch potatoes were cultists who watched television ritualistically, sometimes several sets simultaneously, in a regimen their official handbook described as transcendental vegetation. The cult had begun in California, but now had members all over the world. Ziggy, Kapinski said, something I wonder if you can tell me. Why isn't there a Channel 1? I mean, why isn't it ever used by anybody? Oh, that's the military channel, Ziggy said. Sometime back after World War II, the FCC took that channel and gave it to the military. I guess it belongs to them. The military, Kapinski said. And nobody else uses it? I don't think it's ever been used, no. Okay. Thanks, Zig. Yeah. During the next few days, Kapinski's mind was intermittently nagged by his LSD hallucination, which had been so realistic that the memory of it irritably persisted. Every once in a while, he would sidle up to the television set and turn on Channel 1, doing it abstractedly, virtually unthinkingly, because he refused to analyze why he did it, but the habit was irresistible, like picking at a scab. There was, of course, only the blank screen when he did it. On Saturday afternoon, Galatea called him to cancel their date for that night, saying that she had the flu. Kapinski, who had counted on having her in his bed by 8 o'clock, was instead alone and watching television at that time. He watched wrestling for a while, tired quickly of its histrionic bombast, and reached for the schedule. He couldn't find anything that interested him and decided to watch MTV for a while. As he was about to change the channel with the remote control, he decided on a whim to check Channel 1. The talk show host was there, smiling at him. "You aren't on drugs this time," he said. "God damn," Kapinski swore softly. "Would you like another serving of the truth?" An acid flashback? Kapinski wondered, but he felt completely clear-minded and sober, and as he looked around at his surroundings, there was no doubt in his mind that his natural perceptions were unaffected by anything. "I told you I embrace the truth," Kapinski said defiantly. But even as he spoke, the pictures of his dad from the other night came back to him, and he felt a sudden wave of doubt, aggravation, anger, and confusion. "More personal truth?" the host suggested. "About your girl, perhaps?" Kapinski felt a subtle, visceral chill as he heard himself say, "Sure, why not?" Galatea appeared on the television screen. She was at a table at a coffee shop with her girlfriend Dusty, who was saying, "Sooner or later, Galatea, if they didn't know each other and work together, maybe you could pull it off, but it's going to be tough." "Yeah, I know," Galatea said. "Well, isn't life interesting?" "Sure is," Galatea said, taking a sip of coffee. "So who's the better lay?" Dusty asked with a good-natured leer. Galatea sighed, avoiding Dusty's gaze. "So who? Who knocks over more milk cans in the Lavender Dairy?" Galatea looked troubled, then said unhesitantly, "Tony, I can't deny it. He's more adventurous. He's wild. Mal just doesn't have that kind of imagination." "Such as?" Galatea smiled now, a libidinal gleam brightening her eyes. "One night, I left my door open for him and was waiting in bed with my sleep mask on listening to Brown Lunch on my Walkman, and Tony came in. We had this all set up in advance. He had a couple of Benoit balls and a handful of marshmallows, and he said, "Hey!" Kapinski cried, bolting to his feet and standing there as if frozen into immobility. "Tony! Tony!" Tony Cazara was Crib Death's jackhammer operator. His mind whirled. Galatea disappeared on the television screen, and the host was back. "Was that a shock?" he asked. "Are you telling me that?" Kapinski began in a rage, but the sentence dwindled as a sense of psychological nausea overpowered him, and he slumped back onto the couch, speechless. "I don't make the truth. I only disseminate it," the host said. Kapinski left the room, went into the kitchen, and looked for a beer in the refrigerator. There were none. He stood in front of the refrigerator, trying to shut the thoughts of his dad and Galatea out of his mind. Anger propelled him back into the living room to stand before the television set. "If you don't like the truth, I'm sorry, but I can't refund your credulity," the host said. "But now that you've reached the first plateau, so to speak, I can offer you even more revealing personal truths. Or you can try another category, of course." "Another category?" Kapinski asked, grimacing. "I recommend the universal truths," the host said. He smiled. "These are the big ones, Kapinski. It takes incredible courage to accept these answers, but we have them, all of them, all of the answers to the questions that have concerned philosophers since the beginning of thought. Is there a supreme being? Are events predestined? Is reality mental or physical? Is causality valid? Is there life on other worlds?" He paused for effect before concluding. "Is there life after death?" And then added, "Do you care to know any of these things?" "I want to know it all," Kapinski said in furious defiance, restraining himself from kicking the television set over. The host showed surprise. "Well, perhaps you should reconsider. Are you sure you want to know such things?" "Yeah," Kapinski said. "Absolutely, yeah." Kapinski paced around the room, his fists clenched, and sat down on the couch again. "Yeah," he said. "Do you want to know if there is life after death?" "Yeah." At that moment, Isor walked into the room. Seeking the warmth of the cable box, he jumped nimbly up onto the television set, then curled up placidly on the cable box, unaware of the picture on the screen and paying no attention to the host's words as he said, "Well, that's one more for us, Kapinski. We'll put your name on the wall here along with the others. We got the idea, incidentally, from the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. We don't have any names yet, but give us time." The picture on the screen vanished. A minute or so passed, and Isor, eyes closed, rearranged his posture slightly, one leg brushing the number panel of the cable box, creating a flickering series of images on the television screen. As Isor settled down and stopped moving, Channel 28 home box office clicked on, and the picture on the screen showed a top-heavy teenage girl in a two-piece polka-dot bikini standing on a beach. She removed the bottom of the bikini, and then its top, releasing voluptuous breasts that swayed as she walked towards the surf, a sight that Kapinski normally would have been entranced by. But now, as the surf curled around the girl's feet, breaking in white crests over her ankles, he saw nothing. We conclude with Delivery by Michael Shea. The Braxton Hicks, or practice contractions, experienced by women in the later months of pregnancy, were but a moon-cast shadow, pain-wise, of the real things, Lupe, seizing offhandedly on a comparison, had said, "The Braxtons are like, oh, having a door slammed on your fingers. The real ones are like having a car door slammed on your fingers." She rarely urged the details of her pain on Bradley. He had been a little guiltily pressing for a rehearsal of a sequence they had already been through, for this was their second. He had not been in attendance through most of the culminating months of their first. He had done a lot of drinking during his at-home hours, or get-away-from-home hours, as he had increasingly made them. He had gone to the classes and assisted throughout the delivery, but he had fought off any true inward preparation, had stocked his mind with no clear scripts for the event, nor any orderly grasp of the mechanisms underlying its phases. He had gone in and, fueled on love and powerless empathy, been all the help he could, which was little enough for the best prepared. This time around, he had still been slow to concentrate on the material she gave him to read, but then this time they knew they could make it through. His resistance bothered both of them less. He, like more and more people nowadays, had come late to parenthood, and a lot of men took their first steps towards it with similar misgivings. He had been drinking a lot less and had managed a better grasp of the birthing process. Now, for instance, as he pulled onto the freeway and accelerated towards the bloody gold dome of afterglow and the city's silhouette against it starred with kindling neon, he knew that with Lupe's contractions coming about 5 minutes apart, her cervix would be about 4 centimeters dilated. Through the slick mini donut of her O's, which normally, like a delicate little tide pool polyp, would recoil from his enormous fingertips and cause her to wince, he would now be able to stick his thumb right down to its thickest part. As soon as they got in the car, he had turned on the little beeper provided them by the clinic, and now a state patrol cruiser slid into the lane ahead of them and set its light rack on the blue-to-red escort pattern. Big government had its points. It was post-peak traffic, mostly outbound on the freeway, but still congested on the surface streets to the hospital. The cruiser wedged them laneways through its fissures, prolonged their green lights with its remote override, leaving aneurysms of arrested flow in their wake. The cruiser caused him more fear than comfort, of course. It was the manifested power of the World Population Board, State Branch. The government unflaggingly facilitated the whole delivery process, that is, monitored and controlled. Small women carrying large offspring were more likely to get a cesarean section now under the board than in the old days. Time limits were stricter, in the interest of both the mother and child, naturally. And Lupe, in her first labor, had come very near a mandatory section. She was 7 pounds bigger with this one. Second-time mothers, their limbered wombs more compliant to the fetus's growth, often had larger second-borns and faster deliveries as well. Bradley clung to this hope. He didn't want her cut. The sheer bodily invasiveness of reproduction at its simplest was as much as he could rise to. Let her not be cut as well, halved at her core and spread apart. When they got to the hospital, they found that the alternate birth centers, with their tape decks, bookshelves, controlled lighting, and king-sized beds, were all taken. They had hoped for these comforts, these bits of sensory latitude into which they could deviate between contractions from the inexorable channel of their business here, running always straighter and deeper through pain. Labor, not misnamed. Every 5, 3, 2 minutes, re-shouldering the toil as impossibly large to the bearer as ants' burdens are. So they got instead the classic narrow bed with articulating mattress, flightily mobile on its wheels, even with the brakes on, poised to speed Lupe wherever developments thrust her. It was parked in the classic narrow room with corner toilet, sink in opposite corner, closet, and nightstand stocked with sterile pads, lubricant packets, boxes of white condom thin gloves. There was a kitchenette down the hall where Bradley could get coffee for him and fresh ice chips for Lupe. Spooning the ice between her red, swollen lips, such fractional aid, came to seem the only solid thing he did for her. During her contractions, his baby-powdered hands worked on the small of her back, her buttocks, the soles of her feet where acupuncture groin release points lay. But this handwork seemed pure futility, an impotent chafing intolerable to her the moment her contractions ceased. Their nurse was a tall woman with large hands and cropped gray-peppered hair. Her face had a worn country prettiness. She came in several times an hour to take Lupe's blood pressure and temperature and check the fetal heartbeat using a small hand unit with digital readout whose tip she applied to Lupe's belly with a smear of lubricant to heighten the minute sound's conduction. She had a remote gentleness. Her smile befriended them from a slight distance, from the other side of labor's absolute parameters, which must finally dictate anything she could do for them. Still, she performed the checks of Lupe's dilation they increasingly asked for, though the duration and period of the contractions told all three of them, that the womb's opening lingered near 6 centimeters. Each time, she unwrapped a fresh glove, jellied it with lubricant, reached into Lupe and probed for the prize they felt she would have liked to find for them, the 8 to 9 centimeter dilation that would open their way to the delivery room, the ordeal's apex and end. A new nurse came on near midnight. In 7 hours since her water had broken and her contractions had started just before dinner time, Lupe achieved 7 centimeters dilation. The new nurse was small, her bright eyes and arched nose making her bird-faced. There was cheerful pep in her ministrations, her encouragements. Her smiling energy made Bradley's heart sink. It was an omen of mandatory procedure coming into play when its moment arrived, brisk, smiling, and unopposable. He sat hunched on the room's one small, straight-backed chair, offered the attending spouse like a mockery of rest, a penance for his powerlessness to share in the bed of pain. In the old days, the not-so-old days, he knew there had been some latitude in the matter of cesareans, but big government was so tender of the next generation. He smiled bleakly, so tender it slashed with one clean statistical stroke, a strict cutoff line through all the variability of maternal makeup. He rose to massage her through another contractions and felt like a child dabbling uselessly at the brink of a deep pool of anguish. 10 hours deep, in the darkening, sweating tunnel of Lupe's labor, he had come to feel their task as an endless crawl through a fractionally widening tube. The nurse seemed less cruel to them now. He began to feel a clipped compassion in her crispness. She flung neatly the sphygometer's pneumatic bandage around Lupe's arm. Her eyes pecked the figures from her watch and the pressor gauge, from the digital thermometer. Then she skinned off and coiled the bandage, her abruptness seeming to confess that its ceaseless application to a part of Lupe that would never bleed declared to plainly medicine's futility at this point. Bradley crawled after his wife through the fractionally widening tunnel, too fractionally, thinking hours of labor time, centimeters of dilation equals C for cesarean. Don't let her be cut. No. 11 hours, 8 centimeters. A little more, perhaps, for it appeared that Lupe's os was swollen. The edematous tissue might be concealing a larger actual aperture, might be fingered aside to let the baby crown. Now, when Lupe was almost past noticing, they learned an alternate birth center had been cleared. These were delivery equipped, so they moved. Bradley walked beside the wheeled bed, feeling Lupe floating next to him in her unbroken bubble of pain, but feeling hope now, too. The doctor joined them, a dark, wiry woman with a big black friendly eyes. Bradley chose a tape for the deck with the same pointless care he used in powdering his hands or spooning the ice. Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Sprightly spring waltzed into the room. The doctor's own greased glove was deep in Lupe now. Yes, considerable swelling, lots of give. She would try stretching it with her fingers on the next contraction, and Lupe must start to push with all her strength. They raised a metal leaf bracketed to the bed's foot. It had two stems supporting the stirrups for Lupe's feet and a central indentation where the doctor stood close to the bleeding birth vent. Bradley was at his wife's shoulders now, and he clenched them at the contractions, giving all he could of counterpressure to the efforts that tore screams from her. He prayed and cursed her and clenched his body like a fist, like giving body English to a pool shot that has already left the cue stick, he insanely thought, trying to transmit strength to her through the non-conductive medium of their separateness. It had to come now, or they would be cut. It was time and past time, but even as he thought this, he saw that their last chance was already lost. Another doctor had been called in, a fresh-faced man, 10 years Bradley's junior. Their doctor's fingertips had palped the shape of doubt in Lupe, and now he confirmed it. The fetus was crowning a bit crookedly. The angle would be awkward, given its size. A second nurse came into the room, and apparatus began to root themselves in Lupe. Electrodes taped to her groin to read out the contractions. A slender scimitar-curved plastic device inserted in her vagina to monitor the fetal heartbeat. And this, yes, unfortunately, it was dropping with each contraction now. Not critically, but enough, considering the duration of labor, to make a section mandatory for both mother's and child's sake. Their nurse was already shaving Lupe's groin with an orange liquid soap, foully antiseptic in smell. An IV was thrust into the tourniquet-swelled vein of her forearm, its hollow steel visibly thickening the tender blue rope of flesh. A blood sample was taken from her other arm, and Lupe, from deep in the tunnel of her ordeal, had already said, "Yes, all right, I just want it over." Bradley stared at her, his mind not yet caught up. She lay sprouting tubes and wires everywhere, feeding all the surrounding instrumentation as she had fed with the root work of her womb this infant for all these months. And the doctors and nurses, though busy with this instrumentation, kept moving their eyes to his. His consent was still missing, a necessary part of the proceedings by law. So he said, hearing his voice waver with his rage, "They give you a bigger one the second time, don't they? Knowing she's stretched, can just handle it, and if it takes a section, so what? It's policy, isn't it?" And then they all stood there, Bradley, one with them again, contemplating the madness he had just spoken. Their eyes didn't flinch from his, merely watched him, sharp-edged and depthless, as the readout surrounding Lupe and quantifying her agony. "All right," Bradley said, "but I'm going to be there. in the room with her. Let his useless attendance be entire, right to the end. He thought he would have to argue. Amazingly, when they saw he meant it, they made no obstacle. He would have to be dressed for the operating room. He rode the elevator down with the young doctor, who took him to the staff changing room. The man's voice was mild, sympathetic. Perhaps he was a little shy of this older layman's uncouth rage against medical necessities. He showed him how to manage the tie strings of the green trousers and smock, the cap and mask. Bradley pulled on the paper slippers, and they stepped out into the corridor. He felt the doctor's youth, his greater distance from the way things had been before. Youth's endless adaptability. It muffled Bradley's outrage and hopelessness. He felt mummied up like a fly in webbing, his movements bulky and whispery in the sterile greens as they walked into the operating room. Lupe was already there, half a dozen medics around her, wheeling up equipment trays, adjusting lights, the anesthesiologist sitting on a wheeled stool at Lupe's head, looking up bearishly as at insurrection, when Bradley called out loud enough to reach her through pain, "I'm right here, baby!" A nurse showed him a line he must stay behind, wheeled a stool near him, in case you want to sit down. He wondered if he would need to, wondered what he would feel. Lupe was out. Her belly was isolated by green drapes above and below, her groin shrouded now, not to be their second-born's exit after all. They milled around her, their endless business with her incomprehensible, even their repeated spongings and wipings of her belly coming to seem cryptic, incantatory. Then he noticed a figure more stationary than the rest, an older doctor with seamed eye corners and wolfish brows and a bearded fullness within his mask. He stood between her legs, and as the other's movement stilled, and all stood stationed to either side, Bradley saw he held a scalpel, a small silver half coin on a slender handle that showed keenly distinct against the pink planet of Lupe's belly. It hovered there a moment. There was a murmur of masked voices, and then it drew a long line, smoothly as a felt tip on fresh paper, across her swollen belly. The red line yawed open as it grew, and at the same time startlingly blossomed along its length with yellow blooms of subcutaneous fat, like two rows of pneumatic lace instantly inflating, popping up to trim the gaping slash. The devil work on the living planet, it proceeded with an eerie alternation of finesse and ragged violence, layers of ligaments, white gauze, interleaved the red meat of Lupe, and through there, shockingly, the doctor tore, his hands shredding the rough film to either side with evident effort and exactly the elbows-out abruptness of a man ripping rags. Then another careful phase, a similar spreading aside, but this time studied, painstaking, as the nurses helped the doctor's fingers prize apart the braided meat of abdominal muscle. Bradley knew that this harmonized with the bikini cut Lupe had received, an accommodation of technique to post-operative quality of life. No major muscles sliced, Lupe renewed and active again in 6 weeks, cavorting carefree in a bright bikini that revealed no scar. He wanted to spit, to roar, to swing a sledgehammer against these lights, these readouts, more white gauze now, shredded aside. And then the doctor, with digging hands, was pulling up some deep shape out of hers, clamps and helping hands, tugging to widen the vent for this examination. It was a football shape, one end still deep and anchored, its raised end flattened, tipped with a distended annulus of muscle that mouthed a plug of dark, wet hair. The double door by which Bradley had entered the room opened. Two state troopers, masked and gloved, wheeled in a cart that bore a glass box warmly lit within. They stood flanking it, just inside the door. The doctor's fingers were wedged in the offs now, gripping the hair plug. Briefly, Lupe's womb seemed to recoil, to be at tug of war with him, and then it surrendered with a peristaltic shudder, and the slick mass of their secondborn was uprooted, the crooked black legs bunched like bananas below the bristly abdominal bulb plucked free. The doctor carried it to the trooper's cart. One of them opened the glass box's trap, and the doctor eased it through. It poured off his cupped palms and scuttled around its bright warm crib, pedipalps caressing the glass, so brisk and fully expert in its life's first moments. Its palps cleaned its fangs, and its hindmost legs groomed the tactile hairs of its abdomen. The doctor scarcely needed to check the cart's readouts. All its functions were so plainly perfect. The troopers wheeled it out. Their van would be waiting outside to take it down to the federal building's new annex. Bradley looked over to Lupe. Her womb had been tucked back in place. They were already suturing her, webbing her shut again. The doctor was looking at him. In the creases round the friendly, wolfish eyes above the mask, he saw a tired strength, a strength burdened with and yet still buoyant under a habitual concession to pain, to horror. "That's your second, isn't it?" His voice was gravelly, calm. "So now you can have two of your own." Just the moment before, Bradley had felt himself wombed with a deep and absolute negative that had grown within him through the past half hour, and it seemed to him, until just this instant, that no affirmative could ever germinate in this inner vacancy. And now he amazed himself. He nodded. "Yes," he said, and again, not caring about the madness of saying it aloud, "Yes, and maybe one of them will be the deliverer." This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.